Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating, in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
To the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect everybody, both locally and globally. And for this, the Arts Hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And I combine a debate topic with an arts interview with the show because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. This week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm very pleased to be interviewing Anne Leckie, New York Times best-selling author of the Hugo, Nebula and Arthur C. Clarke award-winning novel Ancillary Justice, the only novel in history to win all the major science fiction awards. Ancillary Justice is the first book in Anne's highly original debut space opera, Imperial Rat Trilogy, the other two books being Ancillary Sword and Ancillary Mercy. Anne has published short stories in Subterranean Magazine, Strange Horizons and Realms of Fantasy, and her story, Hesperia and Glory, was reprinted in Science Fiction, the Best of the Year, 2007 edition, edited by Rich Horton. Before becoming a professional writer, Anne worked as a waitress, a receptionist, a rodman on a land surveying crew, and a recording engineer. She lives in St. Louis, Missouri, and her highly anticipated new book is just about to be released and is called Provenance. Welcome to the show, Anne.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And thank you for taking the time out. But you're about to launch on a book tour, I think.
Yes, I am, yeah.
All over the place, and we're very lucky to have you here coming to Bookshop Santa Cruz, so we're looking forward to that. I wanted to ask you, you've been writing both published and unpublished for much of your life. I'm wondering if you can remember the first time that art of any kind had a deep effect on you beyond just entertaining you, whether it was a book or some other kind of art.
That's hard to say because, of course, we're exposed to things from when we're quite small. Mm. I was recently, somebody had asked me why I was interested in science fiction, and I was remembering a thing that happened to me when I was quite young. When I was a little girl, of course, at that time, if you wanted to see a movie, you had to see it in the theater, right? You couldn't just, download it or rent it. And the adult who was responsible for me on that particular weekend really wanted to see the engagement. This tells you how old I am. It was a special re-engagement of 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Mm.
And they did not have anyone to watch me. And so I was 4 years old, and they took four-year-old me to the theater to see 2001. I actually have very vivid memories of that, especially the ending really stuck in my head really hard. And I suspect it may have warped me for life. But I think that was a piece of art that really made a really deep impression on me at a very young age.
Yeah. That's pretty impressive because it's such a slow film. I would think that a lot of children might fall asleep watching that.
I was always a very quiet child. But the thing that I remember a lot of the film, but I think the part that left the biggest impression on me was the ending where Dave is unhooking Hal's brain, basically,
yes.
And Hal is begging him to stop. That really made a really strong impression on me.
Yes. Wow, actually, yeah, now you're saying that, that would be quite a searing memory, I would think. Yeah, yeah. Did you grow up in a creative environment, would you say, or did you find art for yourself?
My parents were scientists, my parents were biochemists, but they also, for some reason I never fully understood, believed from when I was very young that I was going to be a writer, and so they actively encouraged me in that and spoke as though that was just my, you know, the obvious thing that was going to happen to me someday. And when I was, I think I was less than 10 years old, and my mother explained to me how to submit a manuscript and how to format a manuscript, which was something she knew from submitting scientific papers, but she just assumed I was going to need to know how to do that. So it was an odd sort of hybrid that my parents weren't really artists, except in the sense that I think everybody is very creative and makes art in some way or another, but they expected me to be artistic, and I'm not entirely sure why that was.
That's interesting, because I was going to ask you what drew you to writing specifically as your form of artistic expression. But, I mean, would you say that you were then led to it because of your parents?
I think so, yeah. I had wanted to, I think a lot of people do, wanted to have some kind of creative thing, wanted to do some sort of art. And I sort of flirted with various sorts. But in the end, I kept coming back to writing. And I think some of that may well have been the expectations and the support that I got for that. Talking to other writers, that's really unusual. And I think it makes a huge amount of difference to have the expectation and the support around that, to being able to envision yourself as doing it. It just makes a huge difference, because it's very daunting writing. You don't get a lot of feedback. You do it yourself. It's very frustrating and full of anxieties, and you get a lot of rejection. And the more support you can have, of course, the better it's going to be, the more you're going to be able to persevere and just keep working at it.
No, I think you're right. I mean, that is a real gift, because I think a lot of parents are quite scared of their children having a career in the arts because of everything you just said, you know, which applies to other areas of the arts as well. But you didn't feel like a pressure to obviously do it. It was a sort of positive, if you want to do this, kind of support.
Pretty much, yeah. And also, they warned me frequently, and it was expected, that I would find some other way to actually support myself.
Right.
That, wow. That there was going to be a day job, but that obviously I was going to be a writer, and if I was lucky, I would then make enough to not have to keep day jobbing. That's super unusual, and I
honestly don't really know where it
came from in my parents, but it was just a thing about them.
Yeah, maybe you had a deep intuitive kind of impetus that that's what you should do. Yeah. Do you remember the first thing you wrote yourself that impressed you as a piece of writing, where you thought, I might have something here?
Probably the first thing, the first time I actually wrote something like that and went, hey, actually, maybe I can do this, wasn't until I was in my 30s. I mean, I've written various things to amuse my friends. I think a lot of people do little pastiche things and little jokes. And I actually sold a story to True Confessions when I was in my 20s. But I found that I didn't enjoy reading that sort of story or writing it enough myself to continue.
And that was a bodice ripper, wasn't it? I think I read somewhere.
Sort of. I'm not... Bodice ripper, I guess, wouldn't technically be correct. Excuse me. But it was a very True Confession-y kind of story, which is, you know, sort of everyday person undergoing something traumatic or lurid. And of course, would have a happy ending, usually.
Right.
And they were all over the drugstore shelves. So I read a whole bunch of them, and I said, okay, now I can write one of these. And I wrote it. And, of course, there's nothing wrong with that kind of story. It just wasn't my kind of story. And that was actually an important lesson for me. I discovered that if I didn't enjoy writing it, if it didn't satisfy me in some way, it wasn't worth going through the work, even if somebody was going to cut me a check for it. And that was a thing that I remembered for a long time. But it wasn't until I was in my 30s and I did National Novel Writing Month. I don't know if you know about National Novel Writing Month. It's sort of an informal internet thing. You sign up on the message board, and the idea is in the month of November to write 50,000 words, which is kind of short for a novel these days. But a couple of friends of mine and I signed up, and I ended up spitting out 50,000 words. And in the end, I looked at it, and I said, actually, this isn't too bad. And I had been going through my life up to then thinking, boy, it would be great to be a writer. But every time I would write, it wouldn't be up to my expectations of what was good, or it would be very difficult and frustrating. And I would think, oh, my parents were wrong and I'm wrong, and obviously I'm not cut out to be a writer. And it was, I think, a combination of knowing from the internet that actually quite a lot of writers found it frustrating and full of anxieties, and it wasn't just me. And then seeing this manuscript, which is, in retrospect, it's not a great novel, and that's the reason nobody's going to read it except me at this point. but when I looked at it, I said, actually, this almost reads like it's like a real thing.
Right, yeah.
And maybe I can do this. And that was when I sat down in earnest and just started working really hard at writing things and sending them out and getting better at writing.
Now, I understand you attempted to get your writing published earlier in your life without success. And I mentioned in the introduction some of the jobs you've held before your career as a professional writer. I'm wondering what sustained your creative impulse to write through the years before you got published, and was that a consistent desire to be a writer, or did it wax and wane? I mean, you've mentioned how hard it is, you know, the reasons it's hard to be a writer, you know, before you get published particularly.
It kind of went back and forth, and as I said, every now and then I would flirt with doing other things. My degree is in music, and I love music a great deal. But I flirted with the idea of trying to compose or being a singer, or, you know, various other ways of doing artistic things. But there would be long stretches of time when I didn't write anything, and I would just think, oh well, I'm a failure. I haven't done the thing that really everybody expected me to do. But that turned out not to be the case.
Yeah, because I imagine on some psychological level, when you've got that sort of expectation from your parents, not a negative one, but even so, there's sort of an element of almost being kind of the chosen one, you know, of sort of having to grow into that expectation in a way.
Yes, absolutely. They never would say, oh, Anne, you're such a disappointment, you're not writing. It was never that at all. But for me, it was like, oh, it would have been so cool, and obviously I haven't measured up. And that's something that often when I am in a position to talk to young folks who want to write or really do any kind of art, I often make a point of saying that that's a thing that you go through. And if you're feeling that, that doesn't say that you are a failure. It's just, you know, we feel that way sometimes. It's actually 100% fine and normal, and it doesn't actually mean that's true.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, if you just joined us, my special guest this week is best-selling and record-breaking science fiction author Anne Leckie. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest this week, best-selling and record-breaking science fiction author Anne Leckie. And we heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz in the break there, and I wanted to let you know that Anne Leckie is going to be appearing at Bookshop Santa Cruz to talk about and sign her new book, Provenance. And that's on September 28th at 7 p.m. And in the spirit of Anne's previous ancillary novels and the many roles tea plays in the Rutch culture, the Hidden Peak Tea House will generously and beautifully provide a tea presentation and tasting at Anne's event. So it all sounds terribly civilized to me. What more can one ask for than a good book and a good cup of tea? So that's a chance to meet my guest, Anne Leckie, in person on Thursday, September 28th, 7 p.m. at Bookshop Santa Cruz. And you can find out more information about that at their website, bookshopsantacruz.com. So, Anne, you mentioned this experience that you had when you were very young with the film 2001, and that might have been part of the reason of being attracted to science fiction. I was going to ask you, you know, what does attract you to as a genre to write in? Is it really all stemming from that, do you think, from a deep sort of childhood relationship?
It might. I have been reading science fiction for a very long time. The very first book I ever bought with my very own money was a science fiction book. And so when it came time for me to sit down and write that NaNoWriMo novel, it kind of automatically came out science fiction. The time that I tried to write the non-science fiction piece of fiction, I found it very miserable and difficult, not because there was anything wrong with that kind of story, but because it just wasn't feeling right to me. So I can't say 100% what attracted me to read science fiction or to write science fiction. I can say that science fiction itself is, we talk about it like it's just one genre, like it's all one kind of thing, but really it's extraordinarily varied. You can get far future, weird space opera type things. You can get very near future, very, very carefully calculated science stories. You can get everything in between. You can graft all kinds of other genres onto it. So you can really get a huge variety of stuff just under that label that says science fiction. It's not just one kind of thing, which is something that I really enjoy about that, because life's too short to be bored and only read one kind of thing.
And then obviously, of course, within all those different iterations of the genre, there's all the different kinds of stories you can tell, whether it be romance or mystery or thriller or, you know, whatever. I mean, it's very varied.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What is your process for writing and completing a book? How do you begin and how do you get to the end, which is just as important?
It's almost more important than, well, you have to find a place to start, but if you don't finish, usually I'll start with one or two ideas. I find that a single idea might be interesting, but it's not enough to build on. So if I come across one thing that interests me, I'll go looking for more things to match up with it. And often what that means is very consciously going to the library and reading history or anthropology or whatever I see on the shelves that might appeal to me, and trying to find little bits that I can put together and build something more out of it. Then once I have enough of that, then I can start writing. If I get stuck, then I go back to the library and I just start reading whatever seems appealing. And usually it won't take very long for me to come across whatever the detail was that I needed to keep going. In terms of how do you finish, which is the big question, in the end, it's really just a question of making sure I'm making steady progress, even if it's only a word or two a day or a word or two a week, because sometimes part of the progress is sitting and thinking. I know I have friends who swear by getting a certain number of words a day, and that's a reliable way to build up enough stuff to finish a book. But sometimes you really do need to sit and think. And so I try not to kick myself for the days when I don't actually have words coming out. But in the end, it's important that overall, there's a sort of a more or less steady flow of words, so that even if it's just bit by bit, even bit by bit, you're going to get to the end eventually. That's going to add up. So it's important to kind of keep pushing through. I also find that there's usually a point in a big project where I'm suddenly struck with how foolish the whole thing is and how I can't believe I even ever thought I could write and I should just give up. And usually then when I look at the manuscript, I'm about three quarters of the way through, almost always.
Interesting.
And I have to say to myself, all right, this is the three quarters of the way through thing, and I just have to keep writing because there isn't any other cure for it. The only way out is through, and then I finish it. And after I've been through that a couple of times, actually, with short stories before I finished more than my first couple novels, which are in a drawer now. And I was reading, I think it was Neil Gaiman's blog, and he told a story almost identical. He said on his blog that he was writing, I think it was Anansi Boys, and he got to be about three quarters of the way through and realized it was going to be a failure, and he called up his agent and said, I can't do this. I'm going to have to give back the advance. This is terrible. And his agent started laughing at him. And he said, this is terrible. Why are you laughing? And she said, you do this every time. Hang up the phone and finish the book.
What is it and about said, the three-quarter point?
I don't know. I'm not 100% sure. But after that, I figured if it happened to Neil Gaiman, it was okay.
That is very true, yes. So one never knows how a book will be received, you know, until it's out there. But I'm wondering what your criteria are for being satisfied with a book. I mean, you know, you've got to the end, but what makes you feel satisfied with it, to feel that it's ready to go out into the world?
That, yeah, that's a whole separate thing, isn't it? Usually, if I have the time, and of course, with your first novel, before you've sold anything, you have as much time as you want. And when I was writing short stories, it would be the same way. I would go over it and over it and look at every sentence and look at everything and make sure that when I read through, if there was anything where I caught and went, that's not quite right, or it doesn't feel quite right, I would have to fix that. Because my experience is whenever I wouldn't fix those things, that would be the first thing a reader would point out to me.
Right.
And then when I had been over the manuscript so much that opening the file made me want to cry, it was time to send it in.
Right. So at some point you just have to say, okay, I have to let it go and stand.
Yeah, because there are in the things that I've had published, you open it up and you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I didn't fix that. That's always going to be there no matter how many times you go over it. So at a certain point, once it's as good as you can make it, then you just need to send it out.
Yes, that makes sense. Yeah. Your new book, Provenance, is set in the world of your previous Imperial Ratch trilogy. For those listeners who are not familiar with that world, can you give us an idea of the world context?
So it's a very large universe, and the trilogy is set in essentially a sort of galactic empire. a civilization that has expanded to conquer hundreds and hundreds of worlds and civilizations in a very, actually very brutal and exploitive way. But that's not all of humanity. And so the new book, Provenance, is set outside of that empire. So we sort of get to see that empire a little bit from the outside and also sort of explore a different part of the galaxy.
Mm. So I was going to ask you next what inspired you to return to the world of the Imperial Ratch to write another book set there. It sounds like that's part of the reason, to explore a different part of it, but I'm sure there's other reasons as well.
Yes. Constructing a universe is a big job.
Mm.
and even just the part that I needed for the trilogy took a long time to kind of assemble and sort of fine-tune and make it the way that I wanted. And once I had done that, there was also a fair amount of sort of framework that wasn't part of the novels that was still sort of sticking off, that was part of the structural work I'd done to build the world for the books. And so I'd already invested all that work, and it was already a large universe that I could tell a lot of different sorts of stories in. And so when it came time to write a next book, I said, well, why waste all the work that I did? I've already got a sort of a substrate constructed.
Yeah.
I can move off into another section and do that. So so that worked really well for me that way.
Yeah. Is your intention that people can read Provenance as a standalone book without having read the ancillary novels?
Absolutely, absolutely. There are a few references, particularly in the beginning, that tie in the book to where it fits in the universe, that are references to things that happened in the trilogy that wouldn't make sense to a new reader, but it's not like they stick out as not making sense. It's just background information that a reader of the trilogy goes, oh, that's what that means, that connects in there. But it's not anything that would be, I don't think, confusing to a new reader. And it is meant to be a standalone. It's not the beginning of a trilogy, not the start of a series. It's a self-contained story.
Hmm. Could you give listeners a brief idea of the story of Provenance without giving too much away?
So the main character of Provenance is a young woman whose mother is a wealthy and powerful politician. And the young woman and her brother are in very direct competition for the spot of being their mother's heir, basically. And so she has decided, she's got a scheme to embarrass her brother and put herself in the top of her mother's estimation.
Mm.
But it all goes very badly wrong from the very beginning. And the rest of the story goes from there, because everything just keeps going wrong after that.
Right. Best laid plans and all that.
Yes.
The issue of gender loomed large in your debut trilogy, as you use female personal pronouns for all characters regardless of sex. And in the new book, Provenance, there are three gender pronouns used. And firstly, I wanted to ask, when you use the third gender pronoun, which is air, is that representing an actual different gender, or is it just obscuring whether the character is male or female?
That particular culture recognizes three genders. So the way I think of it is that children are considered ungendered in that culture, and then when they reach a particular age, they declare whatever gender they want to have, or that they feel that they have. They say, all right, I'm a woman. All right, I'm a man. All right, I'm a Nemen. And it's not dependent on things like anatomy, or, you know, it's a free choice of the kid, or a free expression of the person becoming an adult. So this is a culture that does indeed have three genders. They are humans, and so they're built the same way that humans in this world are. But gender, our culture thinks of gender as very strictly binary, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. Actually, it's a good deal more complicated than that. And so I just kind of wanted to sort of acknowledge that, and also say, when you're going thousands of years into the future, maybe their culture isn't going to look at it quite exactly the same way that we do.
You've said that the three genders are not what provenance is about. They are just there. But obviously when you're reading, when you sort of read the different pronouns, it does create sort of a mental disruption because we're not used to reading that. Is that something you're aware of for the reader? And I'm just wondering whether that's something you take into account.
It was something I took into account. And in fact, when I was writing Ancillary Justice, the possibility of using one of the neopronouns that are considered gender neutral, it did occur to me, but they're not very familiar. They don't come easily to the tongue. And it seemed to me while I was writing Ancillary Justice that it would be very alienating to a reader to read a book full of nothing but a neopronoun. But also, I kind of feel like it might be nice to have them be a little bit more familiar. And if I wanted to talk about multiple genders and not just sort of smear away the idea of gender, I needed to be able to use them. So I tried to use them. I tried to use the particular pronouns that I chose in as clear a way as possible. But there's really no getting around the fact that they're not terribly familiar to everybody who's going to read the book. That's just a thing that's going to happen with using those. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've said gender's not what provenance is about. What are the themes that you wanted to explore with this story?
But ultimately, I found what was interesting me about this story was the idea of family and origins and how we know who we are and how we know where we came from and what that means about who we are and who we're going to be. So family is really very important to the story. The idea of possessing actual physical proof of where you came from and who your ancestors were and what that means, whether those things are genuine, what it even means for those two things to be genuine, and what that means when you discover that those things aren't what they're supposed to be. Are you a different person now? Those were the things that really interested me about this particular story.
And I'm still reading the book. I haven't finished it, but the whole vestiges thing, which is how they kind of connect to the past and their sort of history, I found very interesting. It sort of really makes you think about how we think about objects as significant or sentimental. I mean, we don't in our society tend to ascribe those kind of meanings and significance to paper. You know, it's more to things. So by just making it paper, the vestiges paper in itself was very thought-provoking, I found.
It was, and that was a lot of fun to kind of play with. And actually, I had a friend of mine say, you know what this means is when you sign a book, it becomes a vestige.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And I said, oh, my gosh, you're absolutely right.
That's a great way to think of it. Yeah, yeah. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest this week, best-selling and record-breaking science fiction author Anne Leckie. Just want to remind you again that she's going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on September the 28th at 7 p.m. You can meet her there. In person, she'll be signing her new book, Provenance, and talking about it. We're going to go to a break now, but we're going to be back very soon. So we'll see you after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito.
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
It's Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special arts guest this week, best-selling and record-breaking science fiction author Anne Leckie. So, Anne, I wanted to ask you, science fiction is a hugely popular genre, yet I know sometimes there can be a bit of intellectual snobbery about fantasy and science fiction works. I'm wondering what your take on that is.
To some extent, I think that's declining. I think it used to be stronger, certainly when I was a kid. In fact, my own parents, who wanted so badly for me to write, were dismayed when I did not grow out of my love of science fiction and fantasy. But once they realized that I was absolutely not going to, then they decided they were going to accept that. So they were very good about that. But I remember my parents telling me that science fiction couldn't be real literature because it wasn't about human relationships when real literature was about human relationships. They favored mystery novels, which I love very much myself as well. They're fabulous. They said mysteries can really be about people and science fiction can't. And when I got a little bit older and discovered how many science fiction writers were also mystery writers, I didn't have the heart to break the news to them. But I do think that is kind of falling by the wayside. There are so many highly regarded mainstream authors who have grown up reading science fiction, who use science fictional elements in their work, that it's become much less of a stigma to be reading and writing science fiction. I think some of it is still left. Every now and then I'll run across it. I also feel like sometimes those of us in science fiction have sort of a defensive reaction and then do the, well, you're just snobs and you don't appreciate our really great stuff, and they're terrible snobs and they don't respect us. I think that's overstating it. As I said, I think it's kind of that's declining, and we maybe need to not be so defensive about it anymore, because really we're kind of winning the fight. So many younger writers have grown up surrounded by science fiction that they're, without even thinking about it, well, they probably do think about it, they're reaching for science fictional tools, and they have a lot of science fictional vocabulary ready for them to use when they begin to write.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, as we were speaking about earlier with the variety possible within the genre, I mean, it seems completely possible also that you could write a literary science fiction novel. I mean, there's no reason that it shouldn't have writing of that caliber, is there?
No, well, there's plenty of them already. I mean, Margaret Atwood has written several of them, and Michael Chabon. There are quite a few novels being marketed not as science fiction, but that definitely are science fiction and are of very high literary quality. So I think that's a fight that we've already won.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Science fiction imagines not only how amazing things in the future could be, but also how things could turn out not so well if we continue on a certain track. And increasingly nowadays, we're being presented with technological and scientific discoveries with very little questioning of whether we should actually pursue every one of these. All innovations are assumed to be improvements to our lives. Rarely do we ask just because we can, should we? I mean, this is something I think about quite a lot. I'm wondering, is this something that interests you at all in your writing?
Oh, it absolutely does. I think that's a fundamental concern of a lot of science fiction, since it takes as its central concern how people deal with technology and technological change. And so the should we really be doing this is a really common theme, or what will be the results of our doing this? Because as you say, we get some kind of technological improvement thing, and we go, oh, this is wonderful, it makes our lives easier, but we don't stop to think in the moment that we're making our day a little bit less arduous what the long-term effects might be of doing that, or of everyone doing that, what kind of social change that might cause. And so that is one of the concerns of science fiction, is saying, well, what is going to happen to us if we have these kinds of changes?
Yes, yeah. I'm very interested in the psychologist, Alice Miller, who has studied artists at length. And she believes art can help people process difficult events, whether these are events they've experienced themselves or events they've witnessed. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on whether you feel art can have a healing effect, both on those making the art and those experiencing it.
That sounds absolutely right to me. I feel like narrative is really powerful, narrative in particular, but that's not the only one of the arts that can have this effect. But narrative, I think, is a basic mode of human thought. It's a way that we organize the world into patterns that we can understand and then use to make decisions about how to respond. And so the kinds of narratives that we have in our inventory of stories is really important. And the stories that we use to pull out and make sense of the world around us can have honest-to-goodness, life-threatening effects if we choose particular narratives in dealing with other people, for instance.
Yes, yeah.
So when you're dealing with a really traumatic event that you need to make some kind of sense of, the way you're going to make sense of it, it seems to me, is to make a story that puts it into a pattern that then you can say, now this fits, now I understand this, now I can see who I am now in the light of this thing having happened to me and how that fits into the world. And so making that story can be really powerful, or finding that story if somebody else has written it can be extraordinarily powerful and help you put things together in a pattern where you can feel more settled with things, rather than just always like, I don't understand this is terrible. And so I do, I mean, to some extent, maybe it's self-aggrandizing of me to say narrative has this incredible power, but I really think that it does.
No, I agree. And I think also, you know, narrative obviously has a thread through many of the other arts as well, even through something like painting or whatever. I mean, I think you're right. Storytelling is a very fundamental, primal human way of making sense of the world. Yeah, definitely. Kurt Vonnegut said, to practice art of any kind, no matter how well or badly, is a way to make your soul grow. I'm wondering whether you think there's an element of personal growth that accompanies writing, and if so, how important that might be to the actual work.
I have to admit, that's not something I've thought very much about. It may be true. I do know that just the project of writing the trilogy of Ancillary Justice, when I said to myself, I want to write a world without that doesn't care about gender, that started me on a path of learning things about gender, about the biology of gender, about how people other than myself thought about their gender and experienced their gender, that I never would have thought about many of those things if I had not gone down the path of writing that book. And so that's kind of interesting to me, how much that changed the way that I looked at so many different things. I'm not sure I would phrase that in terms of making my soul any better, but I'm also, just personally, I'm very hesitant to say anything about, you know, the state of my soul, because I'm not sure that's something that I can judge for myself. but I do think that writing that I've learned a lot through writing, and not just things like, oh gosh, now I know about snakes, oh gosh, now I know about black holes. I do think I've learned a lot of things just from the process of learning what I need to know to write.
Yeah. I mean, one thing some other artists that I've interviewed have said, that they believe art is a really strong means of feeling empathy. And obviously when you are writing and you're developing different characters and having to put yourself really into their position, that you're having to find empathy, aren't you, with them, which, I mean, I think, of course, must increase one's self-awareness.
I would hope so. And I think it is important if you have difficulty feeling empathy, and I suspect most people do feel empathy for other folks, you need to use that to make characters who feel real on the page. Otherwise, you're going to make sort of cardboard cutouts who are just the evil overlord and the wonderful hero. If you want any deeper sort of character, you really do have to be able to think about other people and how they feel about things.
Yeah, yeah. Creative writing and fiction reading are being somewhat usurped in the new school curriculum, at least in California. I don't know about where you are in Missouri, being usurped by so-called practical reading and analytical writing. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on whether it's necessary for our children to have fiction reading and writing as part of their education, and maybe in particular fantasy and science fiction.
Yeah, that's interesting. My kids are just out of high school, and so my experience with, at least in Missouri, and at least in this district, the approach to writing is very particular into this area, so I don't know much about how California is handling it. My experience has been that that English teachers very much want the kids to write very well and do value reading fiction. But I think in a lot of cases, the English teachers aren't necessarily fiction writers themselves, and so the things they teach don't necessarily help kids to write fiction. But my experience has been that the teachers, at least in this school district, do value the reading and writing of fiction. I do think it's important for kids to read fiction. As I said, it's important to have those narratives. It's important. It's also important to be able to analyze and question narratives, because if you're just ingesting narratives at random, you're ingesting frameworks for looking at the world. And if you don't question those, you run the risk of those narratives affecting how you're behaving and what choices you're making, without realizing that the television shows you've watched and the stories you've heard are actually capable of manipulating you.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, I agree. We hear a lot about the imminent demise of publishing, but according to Publishers Weekly, unit sales of print books rose 3.3% in 2016 over the previous year, making it the third straight year of print growth. So it seems many people still want to hold on to an actual book in their hands. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the future of physical books.
It's hard to say. I have to admit that if given a choice, I prefer a physical book. Part of that might just be, you know, my age. I grew up when there was no other choice. But boy, being able to carry hundreds or even thousands of books on a little square thing that I can fit in my pocket when I'm going on a trip, that's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
I suspect that at least at the level of technology that we have right now, books aren't going anywhere. The publishing industry may change the way that it does business, but you're still always going to have the problem of someone curating. Because if everyone is sort of self-publishing their own stuff, which is actually, I'm really glad that that's available. When I was a kid, you just couldn't do that. There's still tons of stuff. So you're still going to need somebody to sort through and say, okay, if this is your taste, these things are particularly good examples of that.
Yes.
Because otherwise you're faced with sorting through all kinds of things. And I think stories are never going to go away. Stories are something that we're always going to want.
Yeah, well, like you, I really like physical books, and I'm just thinking about what your friend said about, you know, when you sign a book, it becomes a vestige. And I know Seth Rodin, who's a sort of marketing guy, he's talked about books becoming artifacts in a way, physical books. And so I think you're right. It's terribly convenient if you're going away to have all your books, you know, in a digital format. But I think there is something special about a book as an artifact, you know, that it doesn't become what it is, as the writer Jane Smiley says, you know, until you open it, it's nothing. And then you open it, and as you read it, it becomes something kind of in your hands.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. You've signed with Orbit Books to write another novel for them after Provenance. Just wondering if you, can you tell us a bit about that? You know, do you know what the story is going to be?
I do, but I can't really talk about it just yet. I'm at the stage where I can't really talk about it just yet, but probably pretty soon.
So going forward, do you you see yourself staying writing within the science fiction world, do you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Anne, and as I said, we're looking forward to having you here in Santa Cruz talking about Provenance. So we'll be seeing you very soon, September the 28th, 7 p.m. Bookshop Santa Cruz, and with some lovely tea as well. Looking forward to that.
I'm definitely looking forward to that. That'll be fabulous.
Well, thank you so much again for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. That's my special guest this week, best-selling, record-breaking science fiction author Anne Leckie. And as I mentioned, she's going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz Thursday, September the 28th. Hidden Peak Tea House is providing tea. I'm going to be going along, so I hope that I might see you there. It's going to be a really nice event. Hear about Anne's new book, Provenance, and she'll be signing books as well. So hopefully you can make that. I will put up information about it on the podcast page as well. Speaking of which, you will find the podcast after the show on my website, the show's website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. And if you go to the homepage, there are two tabs at the top, guests and topics. And if you click on those, it'll bring up photographs of all the previous guests that I've had, amazing arts guests, and also the very interesting topic discussions that we've done where I've been out on the street getting interviews and also having some special guests on certain topics that we've discussed. And if you click on those, it brings up a page with all the photographs and information about the author. So if you enjoyed this interview this evening, do tell your friends about it. Send them to itsquestionofbalance.com. You'll be able to click on Anne Leckie's picture and listen to it again, or listen to it for the first time if you're sending other people there. And there'll be a link also to Anne's website, which is annelecky.com, where you can find out lots of information about her other books, where she's going to be on her book tour. She's coming to Santa Cruz, but she's also going to lots of other places. So if you're listening from another state, you'll be able to find out if she's going to be heading your way soon. Thanks again for listening, and I look forward to you joining me again next time.